Thanks, Sue. Please don't blame me, but blame the organizers for inflicting me twice upon you. Now, note that when I spoke yesterday on nuclear issues, Ban Ki-moon was to my left. He's now to my right. Take that as a metaphor if you want. This October marks the 10th anniversary of the unanimous adoption of RTP by world leaders gathered at a UN summit in New York. The principle, RTP as the organizing principle for responding to mass atrocity crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing. RTP has become the normative instrument of choice for converting a shocked international conscience into decisive collective action, for channeling individual moral indignation into collective policy remedies to prevent and stop atrocities. Pared down to its essence, RTP is the acceptance of a duty of care by all of us who live in zones of safety towards everyone and anyone trapped in zones of danger. It strikes a balance between unilateral intervention and institutionalized indifference. In terms of its current status, RTP has an institutional home within the UN in the form of a joint office that includes the special advisors on genocide prevention and RTP. It's been institutionalized in multiple government and regional structures, for example, national focal points. Dozens of civil society organizations, projects, and programs are dedicated to its promotion and advocacy in every region of the world. Every year, there are multiple references to it in the UN Security Council resolutions, presidential statements, and reports and statements by the Secretary General. There are hundreds of research projects, books, and articles on it. And each year, of course, it's tested in real crises around the world. There is a continuing controversy over implementation in the policy community, and there is continuing contention about its status as a principle or norm in the academic community. But in the policy community, RTP is no longer contested as a principle. Its implementation to prevent or halt atrocities, however, requires a transition from RTP as global norm to its adoption as national policy by key state actors, as well as international policy by the UN community collectively. You heard Garrett give you examples of my analytical framework of global governance as five gaps, and the shift I'm talking about is from norm to policy. To grasp the distinction, consider two things that did come up yesterday. The global norm for official development assistance remains 0.7% of GDP. As someone from the floor reminded us, our policy is 0.2%. It is not the policy of any but the Northern European governments to meet that 0.7% target. Or consider what I was talking about nuclear issues yesterday. The norm is abolition. That is not the policy of any one of the nine countries. So how do we move in R2P, and what's been the journey as policy as opposed to norm? I'll take you through seven way stations. First, at the end of the last century, the default policy setting was the non-intervention norm was often breached in practice, but never challenged in theory as a norm. Sovereignty is the bedrock organizing principle of modern international society, and faith in it was strongly reaffirmed by the large number of countries that regained their independence from colonial bondage in the second half of the last century. Their attachment to sovereignty was both emotional, in terms of the historical encounter with the Europeans, and functional, in that sovereignty provides predictability and stability in world affairs. And therefore, the United Nations for them was the main arena for the jealous protection of sovereignty, not for casual abrogation of their sovereignty. Juridical sovereignty notwithstanding, however, humanitarian intervention also has a long history. However, the many examples of intervention in actual state practice over the centuries did not lead to an abandonment of the norm of non-intervention. Often the breaches provoked such fierce controversy and aroused so much nationalistic passion that the net effect was to reinforce the norm more than to negate it. As the world steadily became a global village under the impact of rapid developments in communications and transportation technology, the human rights norm also deepened and spread outwards from the Euro-Atlantic core to the farthest reaches of the increasingly interconnected international system to become a universal norm. But this produced normative dissonance between the norms of non-intervention in internal affairs and the abusive practices and humanitarian atrocities perpetrated by some brutish thug rulers on their own peoples, shielding behind that norm. But when some states defied the norm of non-intervention in efforts to protect the victims of mass atrocity crimes, their claimed emerging norm of humanitarian intervention collided with the existing norm of non-intervention. The majority of states rejected the effort to re-legitimize the unilateral use of force internationally by some in order to circumscribe the arbitrary use of force internally by others. Second way station, policy challenge when confronted with mass atrocity crimes. The paradigmatic cases of shameful inaction amidst mass atrocities was Rwanda 1994. That of unilateral intervention to try and halt mass atrocities was military action by NATO in Kosovo in 1999. In 94, the norm embodied in the 1948 Genocide Convention was to prevent or halt genocide. The policy was to escape this obligation in the humanitarian crisis of Africa by denying the reality of genocide. The UN suffered its next reputational blow with the fall of the UN safe area of Srebrenica in July 1995 and the slaughter of more than 7,000 Bosnian men and boys sheltering under the protection of Dutch UN peacekeepers. In 1999, the United States decided on humanitarian intervention in Kosovo. Serbia bitterly denounced NATO strikes as illegal aggression. The UN was essentially sidelined. NATO action was neither explicitly authorized nor explicitly prohibited by any UN resolution. Russia, China, and the non-aligned movement insisted that neither the UN Charter nor the corpus of modern international law incorporates the right to humanitarian intervention. According to the weight of legal opinion and authority, the prohibition on the use of force had become a peremptory norm of international law from which no derogation is allowed, and NATO was not allowed to contract out even at the regional level. Western criticisms of the Russian annexation of Crimea last year drew angry reminders of NATO action in Kosovo in 1999. The Independent International Commission on Kosovo concluded that NATO's intervention was illegal but legitimate. Third station, policy innovation, the International Commission and R2P. So, doing nothing was no longer acceptable to a globally sensitized human conscience, that is to say Rwanda, but doing something militarily when confronted with an impossible to obtain UN authorization was not legally permissible either, Kosovo. In other words, the existing normative consensus was no longer fit for for purpose in today's world. The policy community split between the major powers and the majority of states from the Global South on the question of the continuing validity and relevance of the norm of non-intervention. The essence of the controversy can be distilled into two questions. Is UN authorization a sufficient condition for overseas military action? If UN authorization is not a necessary condition, what is the alternative set of rules and the institutions and regimes in which they are embedded? The two questions highlighted a triple policy dilemma of complicity, paralysis, or illegality. Complicity in the sense, as in Rwanda, if atrocities are being perpetrated, we have the capacity to stop it, and we don't. We are not the primary perpetrators, but we are part complicit in allowing that to happen. Paralysis in the sense, if you say only the Security Council can authorize it, then the decision to stop the atrocities becomes hostage to either the veto power of any one of the P5 or the collective apathy of the Council as a whole. There was no draft resolution that was vetoed in relation to Rwanda. Please remember that. It was collective apathy. Illegality in the sense, if you say, well, in that case, we will accept unilateral intervention by one state or a coalition of the willing, then we are violating and breaking the only law of the system on the use of force that we have, the UN Charter. Faced with this, what we did in our commission was to change the conceptual language from humanitarian intervention to the responsibility to protect, arguing that states have responsibilities, citizens have rights, and when the state defaults through incapacity or unwillingness, or is itself the perpetrator, then the fallback responsibility shifts upwards to the international community acting through the Security Council. Fourth way station, policy development. Our report was 2001. R2P was adopted by the UN General Assembly sitting as the 2005 World Summit in language that added clarity, rigor, and specificity, limiting the triggering events to war crimes, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity, and thereby realigning what we had formulated as an emerging global political norm into existing international legal categories of crimes. Affirming individual state responsibility to protect populations, member states declared they were prepared to take collective action in timely and decisive manner through the Security Council and in cooperation with relevant regional organizations as appropriate, should peaceful means be inadequate and national authorities are manifestly failing to protect their populations. Secretary General Barnes reports, special reports on R2P since 2009 have sustained and consolidated the international consensus. The annual debates in the General Assembly have helped to forge a shared understanding of R2P. Civil society organizations have promoted R2P norm socialization and crystallization. Fifth way station, policy implementation. The UN authorized and NATO led intervention in Libya in 2011 showcased both the potential mobilizing power but also the limitations of R2P as a call to international arms. The consensus underpinning Resolution 1973 was damaged by gaps in expectation, communications, and accountability between those who mandated the operation and those who executed it, as NATO ignored the restrictions of 1973 and pursued overt regime change. Sixth, policy paralysis. The post-Gaddafi turmoil and volatility in Libya further complicated international responses to the Syrian crisis, where we have been paralyzed as an international community in the face of atrocities. There are also deeper structural dilemmas in Syria. In a civil war, a state cannot be prohibited from employing force to fend off armed challenges to its authority. We face the same dilemma in Sri Lanka when the Tamil Tigers were crushed. Outsiders confront the moral hazard of encouraging opposition and secessionist groups to take up arms against governments elsewhere in the world. Most importantly, the complexities and uncertainties in Syria make it impossible to ascertain with confidence the balance of consequences test. So where does this leave us at the seventh way station that I end up on, and that's the emerging policy parameters? R2P attempts to provide answers to the tricky question of when, by whom, and under whose authority force may be used across international borders in order to protect mass victims of excess violence inside sovereign jurisdictions. It seems to me that it's the emerging powers, like the BRICS, where R2P implementation remains most controversial, that political resistance can be most expected. Because of their mediating role between developing countries and the global north, they, more than any other group of states, will have to ensure that through global governance mechanisms and international accountability instruments, one, vulnerable groups are protected from predations by brutish rulers domestically. Two, weak countries are protected from the predations of regional or global major powers. And three, violators of both sets of norms on the use of force are made to answer for their transgressions. And there are efforts towards this, a responsibility while protecting by Brazil or responsible protection in China. To conclude, civilian protection is a wicked problem, with no solutions, only better or worse outcomes. Civilian protection norms impose moral obligations to act, but do not by themselves indicate what courses of action to follow in order to achieve the best outcomes. Because of the unintended and perverse consequences, military intervention has to be the option of last resort. But because atrocities will be attempted again, military intervention must remain as the option of last resort. Thank you.